Well, once again, we are looking at the personal journeys of exiled Jews. And in doing so, we've been looking at some questions. These questions have been directed at ourselves, but hopefully we've been finding the answers to them in the lives of those we're studying. We are now in the book of Nehemiah, so we're looking at the character of Nehemiah. And the first study was last week, and we asked this question: am I concerned about God's glory? We were introduced to this exiled man through the events that surrounded a report coming back from Israel, from Jerusalem, and it came to the ears of Nehemiah. And it was about the welfare of those fellow Jews who had already gone back, and had gone back in a couple of attempts, a couple of returns through Zerubbabel and through Ezra. But the news that came back wasn't wonderful. And it was very concerning for Nehemiah. And it was so concerning that he turned to the Lord in the grief of his heart, and he prayed and fasted. But he was taking a huge risk in praying and fasting, because he wasn't working alone somewhere on a farm in the mountains. His job was to be the cupbearer or the butler for the king. So he was right, more or less, at the king's elbow in the waking hours when the king would be up and alert. So he wanted to fast as he prayed, but he was afraid that the king would detect this. And as we looked at last week, this was something that the king didn't like to have to be exposed to in his presence, mourning or fasting. So that was a problem. He was taking a huge risk by fasting. And we kind of left the story there, knowing that he was just about to be asked by the king what's going on. And this is where we pick up the story this week. And as we do so, we will be using another question, and it is this: is my influence positive or negative? We're all influencers. You mightn't think that, but every one of us is. And if you're a believer, is your influence positive or negative? So Nehemiah chapter 2, verse 1. And it came to pass in the month Nisan, in the 20th year of Artaxerxes the king, that wine was before him, this is Nehemiah speaking, and I took up the wine and gave it unto the king. Now I had not been before time sad in his presence. You know, that little remark there suggests to me that Nehemiah had always had a pleasant demeanor. He might have been one of those people that you just were glad to see in the day. In contrast, of course, to folks that we all know you're not so glad to see. You run a mile when you see them coming with their tales of woe. But it would appear that Nehemiah was not that kind of person. He was someone who had not been sad at all in the king's presence and all the time that he had worked for the king. That's an amazing testament in itself, isn't it? Verse 2, wherefore the king said unto me, why is thy countenance sad, seeing thou art not sick? This is nothing else but sorrow of heart. Then was I sore afraid. Nehemiah has been rumbled. He couldn't hide the evidence of his fasting and his praying and his concern and his godly sorrow. He couldn't hide it any longer from the king, just as he feared. But remember, he has committed this issue to the Lord in prayer. And the thing that he most feared made an opportunity for him. I'm sure many of you remember what it was like to go from being school to starting in a workplace somewhere. You remember your first day at work? It was maybe a baptism of fire for some of us. Not that easy. Especially if when you made that transition, you were already saved. You were already the Lord's. Or maybe you did a similar thing moving from job to job in another place as a professing Christian. There's always that sense of, you know, what's going to happen? How am I going to tell them that I won't be doing this, that, and the other thing? Well, at least that's what it used to be in my day. There was a clear demarcation between what a Christian was and did and said and what the world was, did and said. I'm sad to say it's not just as clear nowadays. And you were worried, weren't you? Well, maybe the thing you fear the most is the thing that will make an opportunity for you. You fear telling them you're a Christian, or at least living the life before them that within a couple of days they'll know, when they'll maybe say to you, you see it? And you know something, the thing you feared most might be the very thing that starts that conversation with the very person that the Lord might use you to evangelize and lead to himself. That's the case here. I was sore afraid, the end of verse 2 and into verse 3, and said to the king, let the king live forever. Why should not my countenance be sad? When the city, the place of my father's sepulchres, lies waste, and the gates thereof are consumed with fire. Then the king said unto me, for what dost thou make request? So he's come out with it. There's no going back now. He has said what it was that was on his heart and on his mind. And he's going to continue to be interviewed by the king here. I think we can tell from the king's tone that he seems to really favour his trusted butler. In fact, he favours him to the point of taking a personal interest in his well-being. Isn't that a nice thing? But that was built up through a good testimony on the part of Nehemiah. We read in Proverbs 18 and 16, a man's gift maketh room for him and bringeth him before great men. Here's an instance of that. Perhaps King Artaxerxes was thinking that if his skilled and talented cupbearer could be helped, his mood restored, and if it was in the king's power to do so, then he was willing to hear from Nehemiah if there was a possibility of that. Is there something I can do to help you? We've often used those words, haven't we? Somebody comes to us and tells us their difficulties, or maybe someone has lost a loved one or gone through an illness or a multitude of things that can happen. And when we hear that or we speak to them initially, we go, well, is there something I can do to help? And many times there's very little that we can do to help. To support them maybe with a wee phone call, a wee bit of company, or even to assure them of our prayers. Sometimes that's the limit. But this is the king. And he means this. Nehemiah's distressed. He's distressed because Nehemiah's distressed. And he says, is there something I can do to help? Pagan king with genuine care for a Jewish servant. And here's an offer he makes that he fully intends to back up with action. And that's why we read in verse 4, and the king said unto me, for what dost thou make request? And Nehemiah's immediate answer in his mind is, so I prayed to the God of heaven. So before he answers King Artaxerxes, he sends up an emergency prayer. Have you ever sent up one of those emergency prayers? You have done. There's a lot of nodding. I would say we've all been there. Something happens you did not expect, and as the color drains from your face and as your heart rate speeds up, you also send up an immediate emergency prayer, don't you, to the Lord? You know, he didn't pause long enough for King Artaxerxes to notice, but just long enough for the God of heaven to notice. But remember, this short and silent prayer wasn't offered in isolation. I want you to get that. That's important. It's stressed here. We mentioned this before in the case of the preparation of Esther. Nehemiah wasn't out of touch, with God. Because sometimes our emergency prayers are offered up when we are out of touch with God. Sometimes our emergency prayers are offered up when there was no other prayer offered in the morning before we left the house, or the previous night before we went to bed. Or maybe the previous days. or maybe since we last sat in the house of God with our head bowed the previous week. Nehemiah hadn't let his side of this heavenly relationship lapse. His mini prayer wasn't his only prayer. That's what I'm trying to say. That little short prayer came on top of his days of praying and fasting. Do you see the connection? See, sadly, there are many professing believers and their prayer life just consists of many prayers. Only prayers thrown up quickly whenever something goes wrong. Panic praying. Talking to the Lord only when they need to. It doesn't rejoice their heart to spend time talking to the Lord, walking with the Lord, talking with the Lord. It's all about needs. I've quoted here before, it's worth quoting many times more, Corrie Ten Boom's famous words when she asked, is prayer the steering wheel of your life or the spare wheel? This barely breathed out prayer of Nehemiah, sent to the throne of grace almost simultaneously with the words that he utters to the king, was the prayer of a man who was often in the presence of God. And he was as often in the presence of the King of Heaven as he was in the presence of the King of Persia. Verse 5, and I said unto the king, if it please the king, and if thy servant have done favor in thy sight, that thou wouldst send me to Judah, unto the city of my father's sepulchres, that I may build it. If you want an example of holy boldness, there it is. Now, this is a culture, as we have been building case by case through all the stories of the exiles, you'll have got this by now. This is a culture of irreversible decrees. The decree of the Medes and the Persians that cannot be reversed. It's a culture of written commands, signed directives, sealed edicts. And the king could very easily have said, Nehemiah, where's your contract of employment? What makes you think that I'm under any obligation to give you some kind of gap year so that you can head off and fulfill your own personal religious obligations? Nehemiah, in spite of that culture, boldly says, send me to Judah. See, that's more than a request just to get time off. He's not negotiating here, I'll take unpaid leave, I'll do this, and making it almost irresistible for the king. This is a request for what we would call today support. Many people who go to do certain things are required to raise support. That's exactly what Nehemiah was doing. He says, I'm going, you're going to send me, and you're going to support me. Now that is boldness, isn't it? In a God-anointed moment of great faith, he asks his employer for the opportunity to go and for the king to make an investment in this mission by becoming his chief supporter. That's asking a lot, isn't it? Maybe sometimes we don't ask big enough. Can that be the case? He asked boldly. He asked big. And he got an answer. Verse 6. And the king said unto me, the queen also sitting by him, for how long shall thy journey be, and when wilt thou return? Now that's got a practical side to it. You know, if you're asking this, I want to know more details. Is this going to be a month, or is this going to be 10 years? What are you talking about here? This is him saying, can you give me some idea of time scale? But I believe this statement says something else. And maybe this is actually primarily what it's saying. I believe the king's going to miss him. I believe the king is going to miss his butler, the queen sitting by him. This idea of this so trusted servant who knew his job so well, they're going to miss him. What's our question today? Is my influence positive or negative? Because there might be some people you'd be glad to see the back of. But I don't think that's the case here at all. Now, why would someone like Nehemiah feel that it was their duty to go in the first place? Look at the job he had. It's an important one. And he might have argued, well, do you know, I'm in a great position here. And just as Esther had come to the kingdom for such a time as this, perhaps the Lord has me right at the elbow of the king for a reason. But certainly mine is an important job. You know, and here I am, a Jew in Persia, and I've been granted this promotion right to this rank, and surely I have an important job. Let Joe Bloggs and everybody else, all the rank and file who didn't go with the other two batches of returnees, let all of those boys, let them go, let them do it. I wonder how often our jobs stand in the way of our willingness to do things for the Lord. I haven't time, and Lord, you know that, and the whole list of, as we mentioned before, legitimate reasons. In Isaiah, in that wonderful chapter 6, we read this in verse 8 after what Isaiah saw. He says this: "Also I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send, and who will go?" And here was Isaiah's answer. "Then said I, here am I," or "I can't think of any reason why I shouldn't go. Here am I, send me." We're more likely to say, "Here am I, but send so-and-so." "Here am I, send me." End of verse 6. "So it pleased the king to send me, and I set him a time. Moreover, I said unto the king, if it please the king, let letters be given me to the governor." Now his boldness knows no bounds at this stage. "If let letters be given me to the governors beyond the river, that they may convey me over till I come into Judah. And a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the palace, which pertaineth to the house, and for the wall of the city, and for the house that I shall enter into." And the king granted me according to the good hand of my God upon me. His boldness paid off. He asked big, he got big. But the king granted him according to the good hand of Nehemiah's God upon him. How did Nehemiah know that the good hand of God was upon him? Well, I believe he had to prove that through faith, trust, and obedience. And he's been thrown into such a situation where he's had to lean on, depend on the Lord completely in such a way as to demonstrate great faith. But coupled with that in his praying and fasting was his obedience. The good hand of God being upon a believer doesn't mean that only good things will happen to them. But it does mean that a good God is looking out for them. And that good God will give abundantly all that they will need to carry out his good will and his good plans for their life. But can a person living in disobedience truthfully say, "The good hand of God is upon me," in the way that it was upon Nehemiah? Bad things happened to Joseph centuries earlier, but God meant it for good. See, goodness comes in many shapes and forms. The good thing that a loving father on Father's Day must sometimes do for the good of his much-loved child is perhaps the thing that they won't appreciate as being good. However, it's for their ultimate good. Then verse 9, "Then I came." Now that's just three words, but there's a lot packed into that because it makes a huge leap from the conversation that we've just been discussing right through a journey that Nehemiah has gone on that has plucked him out of the palace setting and has plunged us, the reader, into the journey from Persia to Jerusalem. So he's on the way. "Then I came." Just three words, but the journey has begun. "I came to the governors beyond the river, and I gave them the king's letters." Now the king had sent captains of the army and horsemen with me. So this is not just one man going along on his own. There's now this posse, this caravan making its way from Persia to Jerusalem. Every province that Nehemiah would pass through would have their own administration. They would have their own officials. They would be looking at these documents saying, well, who's this crowd of people? There's military men here. What's going on here? And Nehemiah would be able to say, well, this is who we are. This is what we're doing. Because they're still in the area governed by Persia. They're still in Persian provinces. They're making their way through Persian territory. So it's only the leaflets, the pass papers issued by Persia that's going to make any difference. And boy, does he have good papers. So he's been given safe passage. What an answer to prayer. Now you would say, and we could leave it there, and they all lived happily ever after. Isn't that wonderful? But trouble isn't far away. What do we read in verse 10? Now I notice a lot of people in recent years have been giving their children Bible names. But I haven't noticed anybody calling their wee boy Sanballat or Tobiah. That's a couple you miss. It's a wee bit like Ananias and Sapphira. We leave those ones out when we're naming the kids. Then Sanballat, verse 10, the Horonite, Tobiah the servant, the Ammonite, heard of it. It grieved them exceedingly that there was come a man to seek the welfare of the children of Israel. Now they're not Jews. They're not happy. And you know, no matter what you go to do, there'll always be somebody not happy. Isn't that right? Welcome to my world. And these two characters were named here just briefly in this point. There'll be more about them as we make our way through the story. But they're just named here. And it will suffice to say that it's the narrative's letting us know that somebody's not happy. What would have made Sanballat and Tobiah happy, I wonder? And that's what I thought. We know they're not happy at this, but what would have made them happy? Have you ever thought of that? So many folk gurn and grumble and complain. You have to ask yourself the question, what would make you happy? I'm not sure that that's possible in some cases. Well, do you know what did make these two happy? They were happy up until this point, which means that they were happy seeing God's people struggling. They were happy seeing God's testimony in tatters. They were happy seeing God's name mocked. They were happy seeing God's glory compromised through the ruins in the ruined city of Jerusalem. They were happy being able to pour scorn on those existing returnees. They were happy to watch and look on at the misfortunes of others. They were happy witnessing and being able to spread the news of the lack of progress in rebuilding the city. They were happy to criticize whatever feeble efforts had been made. Never be like that. And if you are, repent of it. But now with the arrival of Nehemiah and his company, they're far from pleased because they see that there's a bit of substance here. And what made them happy is now being turned in its head. And that has made them unhappy. Do you know if we peel back a layer from that? Do you know who's really not happy? The devil. He's really not happy. That's who's behind this. And he can use believers to be grumbling and complaining and resisting the work of God going forward, nitpicking and all of these things. He can use believers, but it's up to the believer to let the devil in or not. Remember, we've been given armor. And of course, the devil uses the world. And the world doesn't like to see people of God, the name of God triumphing. Pray for the Christian Institute that they will triumph case by case by case Because the very fact that these cases are being brought is because the devil's not happy with the people of God upholding the name of God, standing on the truth of the word of God by the power of the Spirit of God. But aren't you glad we've all that on our side? Not happy. What kind of influence am I exerting? Is it a positive one or is it a negative one? Will it continue to be a positive one when the devil attacks? That's interesting, isn't it? Will I continue to have a positive influence when the old enemy starts his old ploys? Or will I succumb to a negative attitude? That's a test for us, isn't it? Because we can all be very happy clappy when everything's going well. But when difficulty comes, that's a different story, isn't it? Verse 11. So I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. Now it's possible in the reading of this that he was encamped just outside Jerusalem and he was able to observe for 3 days. Because then we read, and I rose in the night, and at that point he makes his way through the city. I arose in the night, verse 12, I and some few men with me, neither told I any man what my God had put in my heart to do at Jerusalem. So we hadn't arrived at the gates of Jerusalem or wherever they, that's a phrase of course for the leadership, wherever the main men were and presented his letters and said, I'm here to do this. He didn't do that for 3 days. He held back. God had put something in Nehemiah's heart. And Nehemiah was being careful as to how he would put this into operation. Neither told I any man what my God had put in my heart. Isn't that a good way to go about anything? Isn't that a good way to go into any sphere of service? You know, you can go to a Bible college or a language school and we thank the Lord for them. We support them. And we can do that expecting to come out equipped for the Lord's work. But they can only put things in our head, though we're glad of what they're able to put in our head. Don't you agree? It's only God who can put things in our heart. A burden for the lost, a love for him first. And I arose in the night, verse 12, and I and some few men with me, neither told I any man what God had put in my heart to do at Jerusalem. Neither was there any beast with me, save the beast I rode upon. And I went out by night by the gate of the valley, even before the dragon well, into the dung port, and viewed the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and the gates thereof were consumed with fire. Then I went on to the gate of the fountain, to the king's pool. There was no place for the beast that was under me to pass. Then I went up in the night by the brook and viewed the wall and turned back and entered by the gate of the valley and so returned. The rulers knew not whether I went or what I did. Neither had I as yet told it to the Jews, nor to the priests, nor to the nobles, nor to the rulers, nor to the rest that did the work. Still waiting. I believe he's waiting until he's gathered all the facts. People would tell you anything. Sits tight for 3 days, kind of surveillance. Then he goes in and he does his own survey. And he does it by night. Tell me this, do things in your life always seem worse at night? That's certainly the case for me. You're waking up in the middle of the night and something's playing in your mind and it just seems like the end of the world. And of course, there's not a great deal you can do about it at that time of the morning. Things always seem worse at night. Well, Nehemiah is going out purposely at night. Now, he didn't have night vision glasses in those days. And we would think, well, how on earth are you going to see really what's happening under those conditions? But we're expected, the way it's written, to understand, though we don't understand everything, that this is a positive thing. This is a thing that's an advantage to him, to go out when nobody suspects him of being on the look. Look at the choice of landmarks he uses as well. Verse 13, beginning at the gate of the valley. The dragon well, which is really serpent's well. The dung port. None of those are positive descriptions, are they? They're quite repulsive, even scary, we might say. But here's what we can take from that. Nehemiah isn't put off. So there's a night situation. Things are dire. And all of these things could have put him off. But it hasn't done. So why this reconnaissance mission? Why is he there? Why is he doing it this way? Well, Nehemiah could have walked into the city. He could have handed over his letters of commendation. But a ball would have been started to roll at that time. And it may have led to mistakes. So he holds back. Not a word for somebody this morning. Sometimes that is a word. Think. Are you about to make a decision? Think. Is that a word from the Lord? And here he takes no one else's word for it. He wants to see everything for himself. And it's a thorough investigation after his wait of 3 days. Now, if you want a wee study to do in your idle moments this afternoon, think of different occasions in the Bible where 3 days is mentioned as a feature in the Bible stories. And only then in verse 17 do we read, "Then said I unto them," unto whom? Well, verse 16, the rulers, the priests, the nobles, and the others that were doing the work. So now he's going to speak to them. And in the book of Ezra, chapter 7 and 9, Ezra was told to put people like this in place. You can look at that yourself. So these are the people, the rulers, the priests, the nobles. "Then said I unto them," he had got accustomed to the extent of the destruction. He didn't run away a million miles away. He didn't get angry that the earlier returnees had maybe put more effort into building their own homes and farmsteads than into the city walls. Because he has a positive influence. And he says, "Then said unto them, ye see the distress that we are in." Instead of lecturing them, instead of coming along saying, "Is that all you've done?" "The distress that we are in, how Jerusalem lieth waste and the gates are burned with fire, come, let us build up the wall of Jerusalem that we can no more be a reproach." Time to move on, isn't it? He could have analysed the reasons why they hadn't done more. But instead of that, he sees it as it is. He sees the full extent of it as it is. He sees the enormity of the job as it is. He realises that he has a workforce there that haven't to this point been terribly motivated. But instead of going over any of that, he simply says this, "Come, let us build up the walls, that Jerusalem be no more a reproach." Is my influence positive or negative? May the Lord help us to work that out in our own minds as we live for him. Pray that our heart might be after your heart, and that you would place in our hearts that instruction, that desire, that burden, that love to follow you in such a way that we would show forth to those we meet that we have been with Jesus. Help us, Lord, to be positive influencers, to be encouragers, to see ahead. Bless us, we pray, for Jesus' sake. Amen.